Today's story is a threefold story, really. It's a military manoeuvre, a people movement, and a religious procession, all in one go. We don't quite get the hint of the military manoeuvre in chapter 3, but if you look at chapter 4, verses 12 and 13, you'll see that mentioned there. The men of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh crossed over, armed, in front of the Israelites, as Moses had directed them. About 40,000 armed for battle crossed over before the Lord to the plains of Jericho for war. These two and a half tribes that are mentioned as being armed and ready for battle and crossing over first were tribes that were going to settle on the side of the Jordan they were already on. So in terms of where they were going to live in the long-term future, they didn't need to cross over. But when they had asked to settle there, there was also the promise that they would help the other Israelite tribes to take the land that they would settle in. And so they don't remain relaxing at home with their families, but these fighting men go over with the rest of the Israelites to take the rest of the promised land. The 40,000 men is probably not all the fighting men, maybe only one third of them, because obviously some would need to stay behind to protect the families that were staying on the east of the Jordan. So there's a military manoeuvre going on, and these fighting men are leading the procession. It's also, of course, a people movement. This is what the book of Joshua is about, that a long time ago, God has promised this land to the nation of Israel. The tribes that are there have sort of increased their wickedness over the years since Abraham, Isaac, Jacob lived amongst them and witnessed by their worship to God of what God was like. But the tribes didn't follow that witness. They've got more and more evil. And God is now going to judge those tribes and drive them out and allow the people of Israel to settle in the land. And that's therefore a people movement. But it's also a religious procession. The priests are going to go first in this movement as they carry the Ark of the Covenant. It's a reminder as to what the Ark of the Covenant is. It's not anything to do with the ark, the boat that Noah was saved in. It's the box that was in the temple, or the tabernacle before that, in which were the stones with the Ten Commandments on. It was a place kept in the Holy of Holies, the most holy part of the tabernacle. And it symbolized the presence of God. It symbolized his meeting with the people in judgment and in mercy. The Ark of the Covenant was considered so holy that it wasn't carried just by hands, but it had loops and poles to carry it. So the priests with the Ark of the Covenant are going first to remind the people of the presence of God, and it's much more than just a people movement. It's that religious procession as well. We see in this story that God leads his people. In verses 3 and 4 of chapter 3, when you see the ark, move out from your positions and follow it. Then you'll know the way to go, since you have never been this way before. There's only possibly four of the Israelites that had been this way before. Joshua and Caleb, because they were in the 12 spies 40 years ago, and they'd spied out the land. And then the two spies that had been, that we looked at in the story in Joshua chapter 2, that had spied more recently. All the rest of the Israelites from 40 years ago had died. That generation had passed away. And so, as it says, the people didn't know this new land that they were going into. But God was going before them. And if they followed his way, followed the ark, then he would lead them. They were to keep a distance, though. Keep 1,000 yards away. Which just reminds us of the holiness of God. Remember, normally, the Ark of the Covenant was in the inner part of the tabernacle or the temple later. Only the high priest went in once a year to offer sacrifices on the Day of Atonement. So perhaps it's not surprising that they should keep a distance because of the holiness of God that was associated with that. It's not quite clear from the text whether the priests were then 1,000 yards upstream or downstream of where the Israelites crossed, or whether when they actually crossed, they crossed just by the ark. But certainly as they were processing, they were to keep a distance. And that is a reminder of the holiness of God. The thing I felt came out very strongly through this passage is the assurance that God gives to his people. Look again at verses 10 to 13 in chapter 3. This is how you will know that the living God is among you, and that he will certainly drive out the 7 tribes that are there. See, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Choose 12 men from the tribes. As soon as the priests carry the ark, the Lord of all the earth, its waters downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap. A few people maybe have been to Israel, or you may have seen pictures of the River Jordan. The flow nowadays is a lot less than it used to be. It's a lot more regulated. A lot more of the flow is used for irrigation of the land rather than flowing down the river. In the time of Joshua, the flood would have been much greater than any of the pictures you would see from the modern day. And it's recorded here that it is flood season. It's not a simple thing to do to paddle across a little river. But it's a significant obstacle in the way of crossing. We're told that the waters stop as soon as the priests step in. And this is a sign that it's God that's at work. It says that they'll see the waters, or the waters will heap up, but they'll heap up some distance away. This place that's mentioned, Adam, is a place where there have been earthquakes and landslides which have blocked the River Jordan for a time. Not regular, but 1267 AD and 1927 AD. In the latter one, the flow was cut off for 21 hours. So you might question, was this just a natural blocking of the flow? Or was it supernatural? And I think my answer would be, to quote one of the commentators, this is the supernatural use of the natural. God so ordered it that what could be considered as a natural event, an earthquake, was at the right time and of the right magnitude to stop the waters, for them to start the crossing and for the waters to flow again at the end of the crossing. The supernatural use of a natural event. The way the Bible presents it is certainly that God is at work. Sometimes we can discern the mechanism that God uses, and that may have been this earthquake. Sometimes when we hear of God at work, we can't discern the mechanism that he uses, because he can use supernatural means to accomplish supernatural things as well. We're told that because of this miracle, the Israelites will know that the living God is among you. That the living God is among you. What's the significance of that? Well, all the people, all the tribes worshipped their own gods, but they worshipped idols. They worshipped statues. Their gods weren't living gods. They couldn't answer their prayers. They couldn't help them to cross a river. But God actually helps his people. God actually does things because he's the living God. In fact, we considered that title a couple of months ago, didn't we, when we did our little series on the character of God. The God of the Bible is a living God, an active God, who shows himself to be such by the things he does and the way he helps his people. And so as they're led in this way, and as the waters stop, the trust of the people of Israel is increased that their God is the living God. But he's not just described as the living God, he's also described a couple of times as the Lord of all the earth. Verse 11 and verse 13. Verse 13, as soon as the priests who carry the ark of the Lord of all the earth, set foot in the Jordan. You notice in the text there that the first Lord is in capital letters. That's the name of God. But the people of Israel always substituted the name of God with the Hebrew for Lord. And so in our English Bibles, we tend to have Lord, but in capitals. That's God's name, Yahweh. But the Hebrews would say Adonai. But the second Lord is not in those block capitals, and that's just the word for Lord, ruler, sovereign, owner. Yahweh, the Lord, the God of the Bible, is Lord of all the earth. He's sovereign. He created the world. He owns the world. He is sovereign and ruler over all the earth. God has the right to judge people when he chooses to. God has the right to give and take life. And that's emphasized in that title, that the Lord is the Lord of all the earth. The Israelites don't have any right to decide for themselves, I want to go and live there, I'm going to take that land by force. It's only because it's what God commands and what God wills that they can do that. So God leads his people, he gives them direction, he gives them assurance of his presence with them and of his sovereignty. We should also note that God leads through Joshua. So we hear Joshua commanding things and the Israelites doing things in response to Joshua's command throughout the narrative. Because God raises up leaders for his people. Sometimes in the leadership of God's people, there's been an overemphasis on the authority of leaders. And if you've ever heard the term heavy shepherding, that would be one of the sort of things where leaders of churches have been too heavy-handed in leading the people and taking authority over their lives. At the other end, there's some Christians who seem to think that they should decide just completely independently on their own for themselves what to do, and they're not bothered about being part of a fellowship with a leadership structure. But consistently through the Bible, God raises up leaders for his people to lead according to his ways and to lead with grace and with humility. But leadership's important in the Word of God. There's also some things that we should notice in this story about God's people and what they should do. Chapter 3 and verse 5 says that they're to consecrate themselves. Consecrate themselves. This would probably for them have meant ritual washing, changing their clothes, and maybe abstaining from sexual relations. The people are to do this because God is a holy God. And so the people should be a holy people. They should set themselves apart for God in this way. And that verse says that amazing things are going to happen the next day. Consecrate yourselves today, because tomorrow God is going to do amazing things among you. There's a possibility that one of the reasons why we don't see amazing things happening today is because we don't separate ourselves. We don't consecrate ourselves as much as we should. Paul writes to the Romans in chapter 12, "Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Don't be like the world." That's separating yourselves. That's consecrating yourselves. It's what God calls his people to do. And when we consecrate ourselves, he can do amazing things in us and through us. Actually, he can do amazing things even if we don't. But in the largest part, he chooses to partnership with us. He chooses to work through us. And so he will limit himself if his people don't consecrate themselves. Are you consecrated to serve God? Have you set yourself apart to serve God? To be different from the world around, so that you can be effective in God's service, so that his power can be at work through you. The people were called also to put faith into action. The way the narrative flows, the priests are called to step in to the river, even while it's still flowing. And then it's to stop. Sometimes we need to step out. We may not know exactly what's going to happen next. But if we have faith and we're trusting in God, then maybe we'll step out to serve him. We already saw last week the general principle that faith must be put into action. Remember that in James chapter 2, 25, he uses the example of Rahab in his passage about faith without deeds is dead. Faith is always something that has actions to show that it's really there. Will we step out and see God at work after we step out? And then the people are called to set up this remembrance, to set up the stones, a sign for their children and for their descendants. This is not just a sign for Israel, but a sign for all peoples. When they hear about this story of crossing the Jordan, they'll know that God is indeed Lord. There's one part of the story that's a little bit unclear in the New International Version that we have in church, but it's mentioned in the footnote, chapter 4 and verse 9. It says, "Or Joshua also set up 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan." There's a difference in a tiny part of the translation as to whether this is referring to the same 12 stones that the 12 men have carried out to set up at the camp, or whether it's a different 12 stones. The Hebrew text doesn't say the stones, it just says stones. And the Greek translation of the Old Testament adds the word other in. Other stones. So there's perhaps a suggestion that this is indeed a different monument. And as well as the 12 stones that are set up in the camp as a reminder to the people, 12 stones were also set up in the Jordan River. And at times of low flow, the people would perhaps be able to see those stones. I feel sorry for any boats going down there that suddenly come upon the stones, but it seems that Joshua also set up stones in the river to possibly these two memorials, to remind the people, God's been at work in your midst. God has shown himself powerful. God has shown himself sovereign. Trust in him. And tell your children, tell your descendants, and when they ask, recount the story of how God helped you, how God led you. And so we conclude with this importance of remembering. It's a recurrent theme in the Bible. The Exodus, some 40 years earlier in the history of Israel, was remembered every year in the Passover meal. And at the Passover meal, the children were to ask, why are we having this meal? And the elders of the family would recount how God had delivered the people of Israel from slavery in Egypt and set them free to worship him. In 1 Samuel chapter 7, there's a story of God's deliverance from some enemies. And they set up a stone as a reminder. And it's the Ebenezer, the stone of help. So if you've ever seen one of those old chapels, and it's the Ebenezer Chapel. There's a few of them around the country. You might see one every now and then. The Ebenezer Chapel, that's where it comes from. The stone of help that was set up to remind the people that God had given them victory when enemies had come against them. And then, of course, what we have here this morning, the Lord's Supper, as Jesus shared with his disciples and said, this do in remembrance of me. Whenever you eat together, do this in remembrance of me. Sometimes we can have short memories. Sometimes the second generation doesn't catch the faith of the first generation. And so these remembrances of what God has done are important to encourage and strengthen our faith, and also to pass on faith to those future generations, that they might trust the Lord and all that he does. So as we think of this story, remember it's a story of God being with his people, God helping his people and leading them forward in his plans for them. A story to remind us to trust in God and to trust him to lead us onwards in his purposes. Amen.